From the broken ruins of Babylon, this is End of Days Radio. I'm your host, Daniel, broadcasting to you all the way from the shimmering Emerald City right here in the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Today's date is, of course, January 25th, and that's 2020. Can you believe that it's 2020? The future is now. Today's guest is none other than Dick Kahn, and he wrote a very important book called DMT and the Occult Mind. He sent me a copy. In fact, he sent me two copies, and he even signed it for me. Are you guys jealous? You jealous? Gonna read the back. With a pioneering attitude and refusal to accept a mundane, ordinary life, Dick Kahn created his very own unsanctioned DMT research program, investigating the cognitive and spiritual effects of the powerful psychedelic drug dimethyltryptamine. Different drug. This is dimethyltryptamine. Once again, dimethyltryptamine, also known as DMT. Setting out to understand the causal nature of the oftentimes bizarre experiences after smoking potent substances, been there, Kahn shares his practical research and analysis with courage and candor. Are you ready to open your mind to what resides hidden beyond your corporeal vision? Well, I hope so, because we're going to give him a call. Let's do it. Let's do this. All right. Hey, Dick.
Hey. Hey, Daniel.
Good to see you. You look great.
Thank you, man. Hat and glasses.
I love it. Hat and glasses. That's one of my favorite looks, actually. Okay, I'm just pulling.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm just pulling you up here on the screen so everybody can see you. There we go.
Are we going out live, Daniel?
Yes. I'm sorry. We are now live.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah, so completely live, and right now I'm just getting you pulled up on the screen properly, making sure I do everything correctly. Don't mind the wait. It's just going to be 1 second. Make sure I get enter full screen. There we go. Just needed to find that little button. Okay, now I'm just going to check and make sure you look good for all our live. Oh, yeah, looking great. It looks like you look great. Everybody can hear you okay. And I did.
Good.
So, Dick, how are you? What's going on, man?
Man, everything's good. You know, I'm good. Family's good. Work's good. I'm in the UK. Sadly, it's winter, so we don't get so much sunshine and it's cold, but we're making the best of it. We're doing good.
Does it snow this time of year?
You know, with the climate change, it used to snow this time of year, but I don't think we've had any real snow, not like they've had it in Canada recently. For many years, you might get a light covering occasionally, but nothing so far, which, you know, is kind of upsetting my boys. They want it shoulder high.
Are you into the gossip mags at all? Are we going to talk any Megxit?
No, I'm aware of that, but I try and steer clear of that. You know, it's no.
Okay, I don't blame you. One thing I did want to do is I just wanted to start off and, of course, talk a little bit about your research. How did you first find out about DMT?
Just chanced upon the Spirit Molecule documentary. You know, I was probably 40 years old at the time, you know, married, got a couple of young boys, and I was going through a phase of experimenting with research chemicals which were readily available online and legally, and I was kind of experimenting with, say, analogs of MDMA, analogs of ecstasy, and I found them to be absolutely, you know, pretty good. So I was up all night, not sleeping, and watching things on YouTube, and I just chanced upon the Spirit Molecule documentary, and, oh, man, it blew me away. I knew that was for me. I didn't even know you could smoke DMT, but I knew I had to try that stuff.
Was it difficult for you to – got to be careful how I ask this. Was it difficult for you to procure the substance to actually try it?
Yes and no. What I mean by that is I've never actually bought DMT. I, after seeing that, I undertook several months of online research, just other people's experiences, you know, looking into it more and more deeply. And from that, you know, discovered that most people were extracting it themselves from suitable root bark, whether it's Mimosa hostilis or Acacia root bark. And, you know, there were vendors in the UK online and you could buy it legally. So I did that, and I followed one extraction process from DMT Nexus, and it was long-winded, and it was terrible. And then I should have read it all the way through, because it was when I'd failed and I got to the bottom, it said, MB, do not use this process. We are now using this more simplified process. Like, oh, damn. Yeah, a couple of messy failed attempts, you know, messy in the kitchen, you know, obviously precautions with gloves and goggles, because there's a couple of pretty aggressive chemicals involved. And then, yeah, you know, I put the glass bowl in the freezer with the plastic wrap over it, and woke up in the morning and, you know, the snow globe was there, you know, the crystals, the precipitate. And man, that was such a great feeling, and still is, you know, if I do still extract, and you wake up and you see the precipitate there, it's like, yes.
Where does DMT exist in the wild?
Where does it exist in the wild?
Yeah.
Well, according to Dennis McKenna, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. I think the quote is, nature is saturated with DMT. I mean, I'm not academically qualified and I don't operate in those fields, but if McKenna's saying that, then yeah, I buy into that. You know, it seems to be throughout the mammalian kingdom, and I think it's, you know, prevalent, awash. I think the natural kingdom is awash with DMT, albeit in very, very tiny amounts.
It sounds like me, you're a little bit of a fan of Terence McKenna.
Yeah, Terence and Dennis. I mean, you know, Terence is a legend, but, you know, Dennis is, you know, extremely academically qualified, clever guy, and it's a joy to listen to him and read his works, read his books. But Terence was a legend, and yeah, I still come across quotes that I've never heard, and they just blow me away. I think, damn, how did that quote? How did I not see that already?
Yeah, his stuff is great. That story of I think the book's called True Hallucinations, when the brothers, they go into the jungle and everything just starts to unravel and reality gets quite strange. That's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, it's a great story, you know, and still shrouded in mystery. I always feel when Dennis talks about it, I always feel he's like holding back, you know. They see something, whether it's a UFO or an entity, and I think he's still kind of like, I think he's still of the mindset like, what the hell happened out there, you know, and I can understand that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because Terence was very much, I'd say he's a little bit more open-minded, but like you were alluding to, Dennis, he's very much more nuts and bolts and very much more scientific. And they both kind of studied the same thing, but had different tracks that they fell into, which is really makes it even more interesting.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? It's like, because Terence was, I think, was pretty big in the rave scene, not in terms of a raver, but in terms of giving speeches around that kind of movement. And I don't know, when I first came across Terence, I must have come across him at some point and not known him, but it's like you come across him, it's like you feel like you've always kind of like known about him. It's very peculiar. I can't cast my mind back and think, yeah, that's when I first read or heard about Terence McKenna. I just can't put my finger on that. It's like, oh yeah, of course, that guy, the legend, you know. It's unusual.
Yeah, it's cool to talk about him a little bit, because you know, he is gone now, so he's passed. Yeah. And it's kind of cool to bring him up and do a little talk about him and celebrate his life a little bit, especially because of the subject matter. But you know, you mentioned raves a second ago. I did want to ask, were you into the partying? Were you into like doing pot and drinking and stuff as a teenager?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was late teens, maybe 19. I think it was, you know, I think it was back in 1988 or 1989 in West Yorkshire. I went to Chaos Night in Leeds, and they had a DJ there called Sasha, who, you know, he wasn't known at the time, and you pay like £2.50 to get in, maybe, I don't know, what's that, maybe $5, and you're paying like £20 for a pink dove, and that's the only ecstasy that's available, and you take it, and it's like, wow, your life just changes that night. I wasn't every weekend, because that first night, it was like, gee, man, this is like Christmas morning for adults, you know, when you're a kid, and it's like, yay! And I realized, you know, I thought, if I do that every week, that Christmas buzz, that specialness of it is going to, it's gonna be lost. So I did it, I don't know, once a month, once every 3 weeks, once every 5 or 6 weeks. But yeah, really got into it and really had some great times.
I had the opportunity to, it wasn't huge here for long and long, but it of course, it always exists. But I had an opportunity to try out the rave culture a little bit and try some of the parties and some of the big dance parties. And, yeah. And there's nothing yeah. like it. It's just, like you said, it's just like an out of this world experience. And it's hard to maintain it and to keep doing it, because it can be kind of hard yeah. on you. But oh my God, is it so much fun.
Listen, you know, I still miss it. I mean, I used to love the dancing, you know. I my crowd sort of went into sort of techno, you know. We had a really good techno club, and we had DJs from all over the world, Sven Vaff, Jeff Mills from your side of the pond, and some real big names. And, you know, I even now I miss the dancing. I kind of like tell myself, oh yeah, you know, a couple of pills and, you know, an underground night in London. I know people who like organize these things, and but you know what, under this hat there's like this silver hair, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know, maybe I've had those days, I don't know, but I do miss the dancing.
Yeah, you look at those videos of some of those festivals, everybody looks like they're under 25, and you just think, oh no, I'm not going.
yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, look, my wife's got her little medicine box with headache tablets, etc. And I've got my medicine box with my psychoactives and psychedelics. And I got ecstasy in there. So, you know, if ever the mood takes me, you know, whether indoors or at some underground rave, you know, maybe.
And I did want to get into the DMT stuff a little bit. So I was reading your book, and you mentioned that early on in your life, you heard a ringing sound that you felt was compelling you or moving you towards this type of research or these experiences. Could you elaborate or go into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, that sound is still in my head. I can hear it now. I suppose it's what some in the West call tinnitus. And I recognize that tinnitus is, you know, it can be a symptom that derives from, I don't know, exposure to industrial noise or a host of other things. But I've had that sound in my head ever since I can remember. When I was younger, it was far louder than it is now. And at nighttime, alone in bed, it was just wow. And, I've got a really good memory of being young. And, I mean, it was so intense. I would wake up in the morning and I'd be like thinking, why don't my mum and dad talk about that sound that we have in our head? Because I assume they had that sound in their head too, but nobody ever spoke about it. But yeah, it was, you know, that sound, focusing on it, had some strange experiences as a young child, you know, feeling incredibly small and diminutive in comparison to the dimensions of the bedroom. And then that would change. Sometimes I'd feel like I'd enlarged well beyond the dimensions of the bedroom, you know. And it's unusual because, you know, in later years I've had acid trips, and I remember one particular acid trip, and it just felt like it was just, I don't know, expanding some aspect of me to like cosmic distances. So I don't know, it's kind of like that. But yeah, focusing on that sound, I had a handful of classic OBEs, and I really wish I would have had the ability to control those, but they sort of came through fighting sleep. I would fight sleep and try and sound silly, but try and be awake at the moment I fell asleep, and I was really willful with that. And yeah, that seemed to result, it did result in classic OBEs where, you know, you're out of your body and everything's just the same, and you can will yourself forward and you can will yourself through closed wooden doors, and, you know, really amazing. But I mean, you mentioned about the research. I mean, there was one experience which I wouldn't say it led onto my research, but I find that it's something I think about and I'm thinking about quite a lot. And that is, woke up one morning convinced it was Christmas Day and there'd be presents downstairs and it would be glorious. And, you know, I was convinced it was Christmas, and I opened the curtains to the bedroom window, and at the foot of the garden, there was just, I can only say it was like the sunshine had come down, and it was like, I don't know, 30 feet above the ground, and it was just blazing, you know, it was just beautiful. And I was just spellbound, like rooted to the spot, like, wow, look at that. And I don't know, eventually I tore myself away and ran downstairs, forgot it was Christmas, and I'm trying to tell my mum to come upstairs, and my mum came upstairs, and of course it wasn't there. And then I realized it wasn't even Christmas, it was midsummer. I think it was, I don't know, we had a really hot summer in, I think, 74, 75, 76, and it was scorching, and it was that summer. And, you know, I think, I don't know, I guess that was some kind of occult entity that played a marvelous trick on me. And I believe if anybody else had been outside at that hour, I genuinely don't believe that they would have seen what I saw, but I believe it was there and it was able to interact with me in a way that made it visible to me, but nobody else. And kind of like thinking about that since I've undertaken my research and published books, it's like, you know, why did that thing come to me? Is it just because I had this heightened sort of tinnitus, spiritual tinnitus, I call it, or I don't know. It makes you wondering. If I take anything from it, it kind of encourages me to continue my research and continue to author books on this genre.
Now, this is where things get interesting, because this is a rabbit hole indeed. The whole concept of smoking DMT, using DMT, and then there being entities or some type of, I believe Terrence McKenna called it an other, but it seems that when you use these substances that you do encounter something intelligent, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I, like I said, I'd spent months researching other people's experiences, reading hundreds and hundreds, because I wanted to know what I was getting into. And, you know, when I did go into it, I wasn't nervous. I was really curious, you know, I was very excited. And to begin with, I had no idea what was happening. But what was funny is everything you've read about what everybody else has seen, you forget about. Once you've experienced that magic, it's like, whoa, you know, you just forget everything you've read. And it's like, I've seen it now. I've seen it. What is that? And to begin with, it wasn't at all obvious. I had no idea what was happening. I just knew it was magical. The things I was seeing were impossible. And I think it was after about 50 or so breakthrough experiences, that's when I set my stall out to try and understand what was happening. But even after 50, I knew there was something magical happening, but I didn't know it was, let's call it, we could call it a spirit, an entity, a non-human intelligence was, you know, manifesting in this dimension, imposing powerfully upon my senses, and, you know, all kinds of visual wonders. Looks like you're in another world. Really does.
And what's interesting about DMT, and I suppose you could call it the occult world, is that they do both deal with these sort of entities, which really raises a lot of questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it was really important of me to include occult in the title. And I know it's still a nefarious word. I know it's a word that triggers a lot of strong emotions in a lot of people, but it just simply means hidden. Now, obviously, it means a lot more than hidden. You know, there's a whole philosophy, law, even maybe science behind that. But, yeah, I thought it was really important to get that into the title, because I sort of read a lot of theosophy books, you know, which deal with esoteric and occult matters, and they really profoundly influenced my thinking. You know, like trips and like drugs, they change your consciousness. Well, my reading of theosophy over years and years had and has changed my consciousness. So I thought it was really important to include that in the title. And I guess all I'm saying is, DMT and my hidden mind. But what's amazing with DMT is, you know, you actually get, I don't want to say you get to see your mind, but there is something, forget entities, you smoke DMT and there is something psycho-spiritual that rapidly and powerfully expands bubble-like from your constitution. And indoors, it doesn't become so obvious. It becomes like an underwater effect and the room is jarring violently. But outside, you know, there are no surfaces for that to transmit to through or reflect from. So outside, you know, just the sky's the limit. You know, it seems to amplify like a hemispheric bubble and then seems to unravel and come back. And you can actually feel that substance slowly sinking back into you, certainly into your face. You know, your skin feels tight. And yeah, I mean, just, and that's without entities. Without entities, I think, you know, DMT, open eyes, daylight conditions, hugely interesting. And that's without entity interaction.
Have you, with these entities, are they mostly, do you just hear them or do you actually see them?
So I think with entities, and I still maintain, I think there's some confusion. So when I'd read Strassman's book and he was talking about entities, I really sort of didn't take away from that they were spiritual entities. Now, maybe I should have read it a couple of times more, but what I mean is that when I started breaking through, I would see like human-like entities, and they were like, I don't know, it was a bit like Stephen Sraza, the Hungarian chemist who tried it in the 1950s. He said the faces of people appeared like masks, and that's just what I was seeing, you know, human-like entities smiling at me, their faces appeared as masks. So I assumed that those human-like entities were the entity, and they were in some environment that was somewhere I didn't know. But, and I'll give by way of example, what I'm saying is the entity is actually, it's a mind, it's a mind divested of a physical body from occult nature, of which there must be a large populace. So by way of example, I smoke DMT in my bedroom, this is years ago, and the room becomes awash with this, you know, dense energy, and the bedroom's jarring. And then within seconds, the bedroom's populated with this troupe of circus performers, you know, and I can see the bedroom, and I can see there's a ringmaster in front of me. There's people performing amazing, impossible tricks. And behind me, there's a row of can-can dancers, you know, with the legs going up with a can-can. So I could say that the ringmaster's an entity, all the individual performers are individual entities, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm temporarily ensconced within the mind of a powerful entity from occult nature, and it's creating these individual illusions and imposing them upon my perceptions and just creating a wonderful, you know, mesmeric show. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And, yeah, over time, you know, you find that, you know, going back to what I said about DMT without entity interaction, it powerfully amplifies your psycho-spiritual constitution. That has, you get familiar with the perceptive capacities of that. So you can smoke DMT and you're on the second hit, you know, and I can sense it's here. You can feel it, you know, it's here, it's arrived. And you take the third and you lay back and boom, it's on you. And just to underline that with the statement of your amplified psycho-spiritual constitution as perceptive capacities. I smoked it outside and boom, you know, it fills the local sky. And this crow just glided across about, I don't know, 20, 25 feet above me. And I could feel the oily dryness of its wing feathers somehow because of, you know, that psycho-spiritual constitution is from me. It's linked to me. So, yeah, as its own perceptive capacity. So you can feel them, obviously. You can see them when they impose upon you, and they can take it to a next level and even invest a portion of themselves within your physiology and operate in a quasi-physical manner. And that's really, that can be very unnerving. But yeah, certainly no less magical than the visual wonders.
Oh, wow. That certainly sounds like matters are far more complicated out there than any of us could dream to realize based on all of that. I mean, the idea that you could have an entity actually kind of imprint on you and you kind of walk around with it, that makes sense. But boy, that the implications of that is really interesting.
Well, yeah, you're right. But, you know, it's like it's there. It's in McKenna's book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. But it's kind of one of the darker experiences that one of his research volunteers has. And what wasn't it? I think somebody, it sounds awful, but I'm going to say it. One of them said he was anally raped by some kind of crocodile. It sounds awful. But he said he was anally raped. But they can genuinely operate a portion of their body of mind, let's say, in a quasi-physical manner. You know, I've had them in my nasal cavity, my thoracic cavity, my abdominal cavity, my skull. You know, I've had massages. I've had the lightest touch possible going around me. And I've also been done over. You know, I've been roughhoused. And that is, oh, gee, that was something. I didn't expect that.
And that begs another very important question. Could these same entities be the aliens that are out there abducting people?
Oh, that is a beautiful question. I'm saying that there's a commonality throughout. So I suppose the first commonality is they're all part of occult nature. Some kingdoms, some vast ecology that we cannot see, they're all part of it. Now, I suppose if you go back to Gnostic texts, there's the archons, which are kind of like external or beyond Earth, but, you know, on the periphery around the solar system. And then, you know, on Earth, is it the Aeons? And there's other entities, or there's the Devas of occult literature, or Buddhism, or Hinduism, the Devas, the Kami, which I think from Japan. So yeah, I think they're there. It's I think I'm losing your original question, Daniel. Forgive me.
No, please continue. I find it really fascinating. But let me take us off track a little bit with these entities. A lot of people feel like, especially with alien abductions, that they might have some purpose that's not in our best interest. Like they might even be evil. They might even be demonic. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, okay. So what I would say is I don't subscribe to the Abrahamic interpretation of what demonic means, which is usually some grotesque gargoyle type character. I believe there are entities that are lower than us, but I think, you know, the what demons meant to the ancients was very different. And your question there reminded me of your earlier question. So, you know, I out of hundreds of experiences, I had three that really stood out as the entity was qualitatively very different. And the one that I just alluded to, where I got roughhoused. I mean, I got done over. You know, it was short, sharp, brusque. Something did me over in the garden, and it was so quick. And then it went, and I could feel it and see it just shoot off at a 45-degree angle, and it punched a hole in the cloud cover, whatever it was. You know, I mean, it wasn't. I'm not saying it was a craft. I'm not saying it was physical. It was psycho-spiritual, but whatever it was, punched a hole in the clouds, continuous cloud cover, uniform everywhere, and that cloud slowly closed in. And it's funny because from those three, they seem to me that they're not like the usual entities that interact with me, but I have this sense that they're somehow higher. So your question about aliens and abductions, it may be that don't have our best interests at heart, or it could be that ultimately that's a aspect of occult nature, spiritual nature, that one day we're going to have to face and contend with, and it might be deceptive, and it might be difficult, but I suspect unless we can face that and understand that and go beyond that, we're not going to progress spiritually as mankind. And I guess I'm talking from my personal perspective, generations ahead, but that's what I believe.
You know, I'm fascinated by that because it seems to me that there's this great wall of fear that's stopping not only the world of science, but just society in general, the world, from exploring the psychedelic research, especially DMT, which is so very powerful on the human mind. What's going on here? Why is it that we are so afraid as humans, as a species, to approach what you just said just now? What's going on here? Why are we so afraid of it?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose I'm guessing that there are existing power structures and influences on those power structures. So typical power structures will be governments, but the influences on those will be from religious authorities, whether it's Christianity, Catholic, maybe even Islam. I don't know. And, you know, I've got a couple of documents somewhere that I may refer to in future works where, you know, the Witchcraft Acts of Great Britain were done away with years and years ago. But, you know, I don't know. I'm wondering whether they may make a comeback, or whether church authorities may try and make them make a comeback, you know, because the church authorities just will not want this. And I imagine one of the ways to prevent people doing that, or influence governments to prevent people undertaking these kind of psychedelic trips, interactions with non-human intelligences, is to say it's demonic, it's dangerous, it's a no, and we've got to stamp it out. And I think that's really regrettable, because my experiences haven't been like that. I genuinely believe that I've become a better person because of it. I wouldn't say it's taken away my dark side, but I would say I've had to face up. I've been introduced to my dark side in ways that I would never have otherwise been introduced to. And it's not nice and it's not pretty, but it sure as hell has. You learn more from that than watching TV, than watching Megxit, let's say.
Is that something that we really need to do? Do we need to go in and face our dark side, our shadowy clone, our evil doppelganger? Is that something that we all kind of need to do as humans to progress?
I would say so, but I don't think it's for everybody to do in the same lifetime. You know, I'm not here saying DMT's for everybody or psychedelics are for everybody. I mean, I come across a lot of people through my work, and you know, I mean, I don't talk about this at work, but you can just see it's not for everybody, not in this lifetime. I mean, for me, I just feel like, I don't know, because of the experiences I outlined as a child, it was like, I don't want to say I was born to this, but I can see why these kind of experiences, they just float my boat really sweetly, you know?
Do you feel like DMT and other psychedelics could help with a person's depression?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, Look, I'm from a working class family in the north of England, and I'm not going to go into details, but my mother, God bless her, she's still alive. She had an awful, awful childhood, and I'm not going to go into details, but in terms of depression and how that was dealt with back then, oh, man, you know, my poor mum, it could have been so different. Clearly, psychedelics were not around, certainly not known at that time, not around, not known. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, I you know, as growing up, I had a pot habit, you know, as a late teenager, young adult, and you know, that caused me some anguish, caused my family some anguish, you know, a couple of times where, you know, you're in bits and you're in tears and you're like, oh man, life's shit and really bad. But you know, Since one particular experience with DMT, I've not had one day where I've kind of like been anything less than positive. I mean, I'm not always positive, but I've got this kind of baseline, and I'm never going to go lower than that, because I don't know. It's like something imprinted within my mind. It patterned something within my mind. So absolutely, I think, you know, can treat depression, but, you know, I think proceed with caution, isn't it? You know, if you feel these are for you, then you're probably right. If you hear people talking about these substances, but you're like, ooh, no, I don't think that's for me, then leave it alone.
Would you ever mix DMT with pot?
Oh, I have not smoked pot for, it must be a decade. But somebody has given me some Squidgy Black. Do you know Squidgy Black, the Moroccan pot?
I haven't heard of that particular strain, but I'm familiar with a lot of pot strains.
I've got a little bit of pot that somebody gave me, and I've had it for weeks. And let's just say I did a friend a favor, and he is going to send me some weed. And it's kind of one of those where, like, I can't say no because he's a mate, and, you know, he's proud of his weed he's grown. So I will be sent some weed, I believe, in the next few weeks, and I'm wondering what I'm going to do with it. I'm probably going to smoke it, but without tobacco, which I think really, I think part of my problems was I was smoking pot and weed with tobacco, and I think the addiction to tobacco didn't help me.
Yeah, you guys do that a little bit more over in the UK. You like to mix a little tobacco with your pot, huh?
I'm in London, and I find I can't walk down certain streets or drive certain roads without smelling weed. I mean, it's still illegal over here, but it's just, I don't want to say it's everywhere, because literally it's not everywhere, but it is commonplace. And, you know, I've smoked, I was a breakfast, lunch and dinner man with weed, despite, you know, my studies, despite a professional job. I was always at it, and I like smell different weeds. Like, oh, that's a good one. Or I smell them, like, oh no, you don't want to. Huh. If you smoke that, you're smoking that skunk, you're gonna wake up in the morning, your head's just gonna be the same as it is now. You know.
And
but you know what's happening on your side of the pond is amazing. It's phenomenal. I salute what American culture is doing, what America's doing with pot and weed, and Canada. Amazing.
And I know that you like to smoke DMT, but have you ever used it orally? Like, have you ever done ayahuasca?
Yeah, I've been on a couple of retreats here in the UK, and they've been 3-day or 4-day retreats. So in total, probably about 7 drinks. And yeah, I mean, I was very averse to that. I was like, no, you hear stories about people puking and purging, you know, going to the bathroom. And I was like, that's messy. I don't want any of that. You know, I smoke it here at home. You know, 40 minutes later, I can be in the supermarket with my wife, you know, with a nice DMT glow. And it's like, nobody knows anything about it. I don't want to be puking and purging, but I tried it. A friend over in America, he prompted me to try it, and he came over, and we went to a ceremony retreat, and oh, that is the best. That is just the best. It's amazing. The puking, the purging is nothing, but the experience, wow. It's you can get more from it than smoking DMT, but I think the benefit of smoking DMT for me is it became more obvious what was at play, whereas on ayahuasca I wouldn't have been able to work out what was happening.
What do you think about the idea that the earth itself could be alive and could actually have a spirit and intelligence behind it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like I say, I've you know, spent years and years reading theosophical works. Absolutely, buy into that, whether it's, I don't know, have you heard of, there's an author called John Lamb Lash, who's a Gnostic researcher.
Oh, and, yeah, I love that guy. I tried to get him on the program, but I haven't been able to nail him down. Yeah, he's good, yeah.
Do you know, he had a website called metahistory.org, and that was just beautiful. I mean, the stuff on there was like, take your pick for rabbit holes, really amazing. And he's not taken it down, but it's limited. And now he has a new website, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's linked from metahistory.org. But you kind of got to pay for the lessons, you know, you got to pay for a program of lessons, and it's not too expensive. And I'm thinking of maybe doing a couple, because the stuff he had on metahistory.org, wow, it's just incredible.
And you talked a little bit earlier about there being other dimensions. Do you feel that there could be an astral plane, like somewhere where we actually visit when we go to sleep at night?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was just I'd read it before, but there's a classic work. I've probably got it here behind me, actually. No, wrong one. The Astral Plane by C.W. Ledbetter. And that's just such a good... It's available online, you know, PDF. And it's such a interesting read and probably a great introduction into the occult or esoteric mindset. So absolutely, yeah, I think that's beyond the etheric plane. I think that's probably the third plane after the physical plane. Amazing. Yeah, really amazing. You know, all kinds of different denizens in there, and for sure I suppose some aspect of us, our ego will go there when we die.
Yeah, it really makes you wonder, because DMT, I know that it is involved in sleep, so I have to wonder, if do you feel it might be opening some kind of portal when we use it? Maybe we actually jump into some sort of DMT dimension right away.
So what I found is, it certainly looked like I was going to another realm, another world, another dimension. But what I found from my research is that smoking DMT would amplify my mind very powerfully. And then something would manifest in this dimension, impose very powerfully upon me. Mesmerically, I say, because you're left, you're just awestruck. It just imposes visual wonders upon you that are so beyond your imagination. You are literally mesmerized, you know, and you know, I like the example that I alluded to earlier with the circus performance in my bedroom. Something happened and I wanted to speak, and I'm struggling to speak because I'm in that, my mind is in that mesmeric state. And when you're in that state, you know, you kind of like...
It reminds me of a biblical experience. Like you're awestruck and something's trying to communicate with you, but in a way that is that they wouldn't be able to do with just words. Like they're able to communicate with you with visual stuff and just feeling and ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, on the ayahuasca, I mean, it's just, I'm going to say it's so educational in a, and I'll say it in a cartoonish manner. I mean, the things that you see, it's like you're getting like a whole biology seminar at university level, but cartoonishly pictorial. And it's just so beautiful. You know what I mean? I'm not saying I come away from that and I could sit like a, you know, like an advanced academic qualification because I've been given that knowledge. But you come away with a really deep and profound appreciation for the natural systems at play, whether it's biology or, you know, whatever, just the plant kingdom and the microorganisms. And now it all links in and they're kind of giving you that visually. So it's not that they're like talking to you, but you know, that on ayahuasca, wow. You know, I mean, look, with ayahuasca, I mean, I'm a family man, so I've got commitments, but if I had the time and if I had the money, because they do charge quite a lot on these retreats, it's I wish I had more money in my wallet, I would go every weekend, I would, but I can't afford it, and I've got family commitments. But I believe there are people who frequent these retreats, you know, quite often. Lucky them.
Dick, at what point did you think to yourself, hey, I got to actually sit down and write a book about this stuff?
Yeah, good question. I kind of, you know what? I was putting a lot of energy into this, and I was on DMT Nexus. And, you know, I don't know, it's like you're just so amazed and you want to share your experiences. And I was doing that, and other people were doing that. And there were like some people on there that were just like a little bit short with new users or people who were still like a little bit green and new to it, like myself. And I thought, you know what, I could like put all my energy into just like putting my trip reports on DMT Nexus, or I could just write them for myself. So I just started writing them for myself, and there was no intention to write a book at all. And then there was I don't know. There's a guy over here, celebrity over here called Stephen Fry. I don't know if you know him. He's supposedly a national treasure. I mean, yeah, he's all right. I like him. And he gave a speech at one of these like film or TV award ceremonies, and he was talking about script writers, but he was saying more broadly, if anybody's got the inkling to write a book or a script or whatever, he said, do it. Don't think about it. I was like, whoa, I am going to write a book on DMT. That's it. And it was from that moment, well, we're here talking now.
Have you ever had any paranormal or supernatural experiences, seen any UFOs, had anything fly around the room, anything like that?
That is such a great question, because look, I mean, you're on Twitter, I'm on Twitter, and I'm like trying to engage with some of the UFO community on Twitter, and I'm telling you, some of them are hard work, some of them are converted, some of them such hard work. So look, I smoke DMT quite a number of times, and I've observed what I suppose a ufologist would call a black orb UFO. I have smoked DMT outside quite a few times, and I have seen what a ufologist would call an earth light. I've smoked DMT in my garden, and I have had like a playful light just slowly breezing around, and it disappears over the neighbor's fence behind me, and I'm like a child, I'm full of glee, and I'm like screaming, bring it back, and it comes back out, like, yes. So yeah, I've seen, I wouldn't say I've seen discs, but I've seen a lot of, you know, I mean, I called my family out one time, you know, there was this irregular shaped black mass that manifested maybe, I don't know, let's say in feet, let's say about 400-500 feet away from our house, and it was low in the sky. And I called my family out, and I was like, look at that. And they were all like, what? And I'm like, what the hell's wrong with them? I said, that then, it's a black balloon. I was like, what? And, it was so puzzling. Their reaction was totally not what I expected. I kind of regretted calling them out. So get back in the house, you know. But, yeah, many times, you know, and I've seen things. Black orb UFOs, you know, pretty low, slowly traverse the sky. I've seen things higher. So, yeah, and I kind of like those, because committing to a breakthrough dose, you know, it's not so easy. It's quite, you know, you got to have some metal about you to commit to that. Whereas those kind of like sub breakthrough doses that really powerfully amplify your psycho spiritual constitution, get like a black orb UFO appearing or an earth light, it's really good, because it's like something from the occult realms has recognized what you've done. It's kind of like waving at you, like, hey, down there. Honestly, and it just transposes my emotions and mood. I become like a little child. You're like, yeah, you know, somebody's there, something's there, and yeah, amazing.
It's funny, because a lot of what you describe and a lot of what I've read, it almost sounds like these entities, they use some kind of technology, because it seems like people do see ships and they do see flashing orbs and things like that. What do you think of that? Could there be some kind of technology that these entities are using in another dimension?
Do you know what? Again, that's such a good question, Daniel. It does make you wonder. And I said earlier that I've had hundreds of experiences, and three really stood out as being a qualitatively very different entity. And another of those was, I was at home, it was Saturday, it was like late afternoon, it was foggy, you know, it's just foggy and not my kind of favoured DMT smoking weather, but I'm sure something was subliminally influencing me, you know, smoke DMT. There wasn't the voice in my head, but there was like something, and it's like, I don't know, in the end I was like, oh, okay, I'll commit to like, you know, 15 milligrams. No problem, manageable. So in the pipe, outside, laid down in the foggy garden, the air still and silent, and I vacuum down this 15 milligram and lay back, and this thing is just there straight away. It just emerges into visibility. It's like, I was like, shit, it was waiting for me. And this thing came down. It a portion of it entered into my head, did something, and then it just off at a 45 degree angle. Now, that thing, it was like made of constructible pieces. Not physically, but my amplified psycho-spiritual constitution with its perceptive capacities could tell this thing was put together like a puzzle. And it was, this was a disc-shaped entity. I would say, what, maybe 3-4 foot across, and it had these very distinct constructible pieces and a very distinct feel to it that I've never experienced since. So in terms of that question, and in terms of that experience, does make me wonder, because the most common entities, they just seem like really powerful minds. But that was something different, and I don't quite know what, but I don't know. Those powerful minds that are common to the DMT experience, I suspect these are more earthbound, whereas those things, they just seem more skyward to me. Don't know, it makes me wonder.
In terms of psychedelics or entheogens or substances, whatever word people like to use, whatever they prefer, do you feel that these should all be legalized? Should they all be legal?
You know, I great question. I've thought about this, and I'm tempted to say I think all drugs should be legalized. But then if somebody says, well, what about fentanyl? You're like, oh, don't ask me about the fentanyl, you know, because I think that's really bad stuff and it's killing people. So I don't know. If you're going to say legalize all drugs, are you including those like really horrible? I mean, there's one in Russia. Is it called Crocodile? And you see people's arms and you can see the bones. I mean, I don't want to be legalizing stuff like that. I don't know what the answer is. I know in Portugal, they did a project, a social engineering project, some kind of project, and they legalized all drugs, and they didn't find massive uptake. They found, I think, from a public health perspective, it was a good solution. It worked, and I don't like. For DMT, it's not so bad because I can buy back, but for other drugs, say, people are buying pills and they don't know what's in them. I think the governments are being absolutely remiss from a public health perspective in not kind of having some, I don't know, better approach than they are doing at the moment. You know, it's just whatever you buy, whatever you get. But if you can't get it tested at a festival and you take it and you suffer, or, you know, somebody loses a son or daughter, that's despicable. And I think the governments are being remiss about that. Legalization, it would have to come with a whole heap of education about age limits, which is a whole other discussion, and where it's sold and who it's sold to, and whether you get it from a pharmacy or a doctor or whether you need a license to, I don't know. But as it stands now, I think it's silly. And I also think governments are losing a lot in tax. I mean, you know, I don't just smoke DMT. I've got a penchant for other things occasionally. And I know that the person I'm giving my money to, you know, it's not going to the tax man. So I think it's time to just get real, you know, and at least have a sensible adult discussion around drug use.
Have you done the thing yet where you get the stuff out of the frog's ward and then smoke that?
Like I said, I my wife's got her medicine box and I've got my medicine box, and I'm, you know, since writing books, I've made a lot of really good friends from all around the world, and some of them been magnificently gracious in gifting me synthetic 5-MeO-DMT and the genuine toad medicine enough to conduct further research. As yet, I'm still a virgin as far as 5-MeO goes, but you know, I'm looking forward to spring. That's where I fixed it in my mind. Come spring, we're going to make some efforts to experience that. I'm going to get myself a really good set of scales because I know this stuff is uber potent. I'm probably going to have my wife watching over me through the kitchen window because, you know, I've read about it and, you know, I don't want anything to go wrong. But yeah, I'm really excited by it. I'm really excited to see whether, based on my research and my approach, which has pretty much been daylight and open our eyes, whether it's qualitatively any different or how different it is to 5-MeO to N,N,DMT, and whether it's entity interaction. I've got some assumptions. I assume it is. I'm just assuming it somehow attracts a far more powerful entity. Some of the experiences from other users that I've read are just incredible.
And speaking of bad experiences, things like that, let's say that I haven't done DMT before and I'm really curious to try it. What recommendations do you have where I can prepare myself or fix things up where I'm going to have a positive experience?
I think if you're starting off with curiosity, then that's a positive. That's really good. Keep that curiosity. It's the classic, isn't it? It's set and setting. Be somewhere where you're comfortable, you're relaxed, and there's going to be no telephones ringing, no knocking at the door, no disturbances. And I think, you know, if it's your first time, maybe have somebody that you trust just watching over you. First time I did it, I had my wife watching over me. I think that's really important. And, you know, just be curious, respectful. I suppose this is down to the individual, but if it's your first time, don't feel obliged to go big. But I know some do jump in at the deep end, and you know, if you feel that's what you want to do, then do it. And just remember to breathe, because sometimes what you see is so astonishing, it literally takes your breath away. I mean, I had that. You know, it was a very short experience. It was the experience after the circus troupe performance experience. The next day I smoked, and I just couldn't breathe. And all these human-like entities, you know, human-like faces could see me, and they all exhibited, you know, a look of great concern on their face. You know, look at this human, man, he's struggling to breathe. And and they dissipate really quickly. And it's like, oh, my God. And I was after that. I didn't touch it for months, you know what I mean? Months and months. So I don't want to, I'm probably putting a lot of people off here. I don't want to, this was like maybe, I don't know, this was maybe like, I'm well over 50 experiences by this point. So don't be put off. Just remember to breathe, you know, just observe and breathe and you'll be good.
And this is a double whammy I'm going to hit you with. What do you think of LSD, and also what do you think of mushrooms?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, like I said, I've got my own little medicine box, and I tick both those boxes. And
yeah, that box sounds more and more interesting every time you bring it up. Just don't tell anybody where it's at. That thing's going to go quick.
I mean, look, I'm like of an age, and, you know, I've been trying DMT, and I'm writing the book and on social media, and you get to know people, and I managed to get some really, really high quality blotter acid, and I'd not taken it for, it must have been 50, must have been 20 years. And like, you know, my wife's at work and my boys are at school. I was like, all right, let's do it. Let's take an acid tab and clean the shed. Let's be busy. And, oh, that was just, it was beautiful. But I tell you what, I don't want to say it floored me, but you know, you're looking at like 8, 9, 10, 11, maybe 12 hours. But I mean, yeah, beautiful, beautiful substance. I tend to, I've been saying a microdose, but that's not true. I'm a light doser, so I will take a tab and I will cut it into, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 slivers and take one of those. You know, I've got some in my wallet. I'll take one, and it's just a nice, I can feel it, but I can drive, I can shop, I can function with my family. Can go to a restaurant, watch a movie, da, da, da. But I've just got that nice, slow, you know, euphoric feeling. Really, really nice. And that's every, I don't know, not every week, once every couple of weeks, something like that, maybe more. And mushrooms, oh man, let me tell you a story about mushrooms. I took 5 dried grams years ago. A few years ago, and I'd been reading one of John Lamlasher's books, Not in His Image, and it was talking about the Gnostics being, I remember that they were known as the standing race, because they would, I think, take these entheogens, and for whatever reason, I don't recall, they would remain standing. So I said, I'm going to take 5 dry grams, and I'm going to stay stood up. all night, and I was in this little office writing room, and took 5 dry grams, and I tell you what, me and my boys, they were like coming upstairs, and I was acting as a monster, and it was just brilliant. And I managed to stand up all night, and then right at the end, it was like, I don't know, you have this like sort of mini breakthrough, and you feel like the creator of the universe has kind of like recognized what you've done, and now you are in a sort of like almost like a one-to-one or appraisal meeting with the creator, and it just blows your mind, and it's like, wow. So that was great. So then the next weekend, it was like, okay, I'm going to take 5 dry grams. I'll never tell anybody this story. And we had two girls staying over. We were doing a friend a favor. So we had my two boys and these two girls, and I stupid, took 5 dry grams in the bath, and it comes on, and then go downstairs, and I'm playing music, and one of these girls come up to me, and she's like, I want such and such a song, I want such and such a song, and I knew that song, and I didn't like that song, so I said, we're having this. And from that moment on, that trip took a real bad turn, to the extent that I had to go outside the house, because being inside the house was, it was almost like, here's Johnny in The Shining with what was imposing and going through my mind. I had to go outside, and I was on the trampoline, and I'm not going to say what I was saying, but I was saying it over and over, over and over, must have said it thousands of times, and I came back in the house, and I thought I was over it, and that thing just still there, you know, I was like, oh, I'd never experienced such darkness. Went back outside, I'm on the trampoline, it's like, you know, it's nighttime, it's dark, and in the end, it went when I broke, and I have this, like, you know, I love my mum, but we've always kind of, like, had an awkward relationship, and I just broke, and I just wailed for my mum, you know, it broke me, and once I'd done that, whatever it was went and left me alone, and I've not tried mushrooms since then. I mean, I've got them, but you know, it's like, whoa, I want to be careful with that stuff. I will try them again, but yeah, that was a lesson. That was a real, that was a, what they call a bad trip, but I would say challenging. And I learned a lot from that.
It sounds like you have a little bit of an interest in Gnosticism. Do you feel Gnosticism could be the ultimate truth?
I suspect it's making a comeback from the influences that I'm picking up on Twitter. And I suspect it's probably something that Western society in the coming generations is probably going to have to rediscover and re-verify or add to. Because, I mean, Gnosticism is based on it wants knowledge, but not only does it want knowledge, it wants understanding, and it wants to apply that understanding wisely. I think so, yeah. I don't think any of the, you know, I know I need to tread carefully, because a lot of people do subscribe to a religion and it means a lot to them, but I just think there are, I don't know, I find I get more truth from direct experience of the other, the phenomena, as some ufologists call it, rather than reading the Bible or the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or any other, or even the theosophical books. I find that direct experience trumps all that. That said, I love reading, and I've found since smoking DMT, I watch very little TV, and I've probably got about 4 or 5 books on the go at the moment.
Would you consider yourself to be a shaman?
No, absolutely not. No. And I know some people, you know, it kind of makes me laugh, you know, like, and there's some funny memes, you know, on social media, you know, like, drinks ayahuasca once and, like, you know, highly qualified shaman. No, no, not at all. And to be honest, I'm not... I'm probably going to again upset a lot of people. I'm not really sure shamans are all that. And I don't want to discredit or disrespect those shamans from the Amazon, because look, the last ayahuasca experience I had was with an absolute legend from there. And those Icaros songs, it's just beautiful. But I try and contrast that with what happened in Egypt when those structures and pyramids were built. You read about astronomer priests, and you try and read about those, you know, the early Gnostics. And I try and contrast, well, their knowledge compared to, and it's not to discredit the knowledge of the guy in the jungle, the shaman, but I don't know, you know, they're sort of different aspects, aren't they? The guy in the jungle, his knowledge is jungle-based, whereas whoever these guys were that were not building but designing these amazing structures that are around the world, astronomer priests, you kind of think, well, yeah, man, they must have some great, great knowledge. I mean, it's in the name, isn't it? An astronomer priest, you know, they knew the skies, they mapped the skies, they built structures that mirrored the skies and contained all kinds of amazing mathematical truths and synchronicities. I mean, wow. But for the record, I'm not calling myself an astronomer priest, but I tell you what, if somebody could say, what do you want to be, a shaman or an astronomer priest? I'd be an astronomer priest. No competition.
What about this idea that there is an Illuminati out there? Any thoughts on an Illuminati?
That's a great question, and I've read into it. You know, the guy that founded it or started it, wasn't it Adam Weishaupt? I don't know if I pronounced his surname properly, but when you read into it, you know, it came to with him that the secret was that then there was no secret. But in reality, I think he was proposing that man having power over other men was the ultimate power, and that becomes sort of dark and worrying. And I'm not a Mason. I'm not being asked to be a Mason. I don't think I would, should I be asked. But I think he probably nefariously influenced that fraternal brotherhood, and I think that's still there now. I mean, Illuminati means an illuminated one. I suppose from my own perspective, and I'm not calling myself an Illuminati, but I feel that since smoking DMT and what I've seen, I've illuminated myself to a small degree. But yeah, I suppose there are individuals in organizations out there, as we said, people and organizations that are looking to influence governments. Yeah, I guess they're out there. I would guess they're out there.
Because I have to wonder, we know that there's a link here between DMT and an occult world. I have to wonder if these guys are doing similar things to what ordinary psychonaut explorers might be doing with the DMT and stuff, except they're doing it behind closed doors and they're keeping it all secret.
It makes you wonder. I mean, one author in this field is, and he's a friend, P.D. Newman, you know, I mean, his book, Alchemically Stoned, is eye-opening, to say the least. And, you know, he's shared with me some of his research that I think he'll be putting in a future book. And it's just, wow, it's just mind-blowing. I can't share any of it with you, but, you know, it's a name to watch. You know, he's operating at an academic scholarly level, you know. Yeah, it makes you wonder. And obviously, Rick Strassman's research was funded by the Scottish Rite Freemasons. And I kind of wonder, because I think they were interested in the links with DMT and schizophrenia. But I wonder whether there was something deeper and whether they knew or had suspicions, you know, before then that, you know, that DMT did impose mystical states or altered states of consciousness. Makes you wonder. I don't believe that we're discovering anything new. I think this has been known as a science way back in the day. You know, when I was alluding to those astronomer priests way back, I think this has been known. Whether it was ever smoked or not, I don't know, but certainly imbibed. Yeah, I buy into that. You know, you hear about the rites in Greece, you know, Eurasian rites, where they had the common rites and the more mystical ones that people weren't allowed to know about or speak about. And there's something going on there for sure.
What about the fact that, for example, in the rainforest, some of these shamans, they'll use the substance to communicate with ancestors? What do you think of the idea that you might be able to communicate with the dead with DMT? Is that possible?
So from my understanding of reading Theosophy, and we've already touched on the astral plane, Let's say ghosts. My understanding of ghosts is it's the ego, the personality that remains behind in the astral world and can persist for some time. And these are the kind of things that mediums actually communicate with when they're doing their mediumship. But it's not the real us, the real you, the real me. It's an astral shell. So I don't know, ancestors, and I've not experienced that. I have a friend who the guy that went to ayahuasca first ayahuasca ceremony with, and his first ayahuasca ceremony, he'd been into the jungles in Brazil, and he'd drunk ayahuasca, and he didn't know that his longtime friend back in the UK had died, like within around the same time, and he says he met his friend in that realm, clear as I'm looking at this laptop now, you know, and that kind of, I believe him, you know, he tells you this story, it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. But for me, I've not met any ancestors, but I've heard accounts of people who have. So I don't know, because when you read the NDA, the near death experience reports, there are reports of, you know, people sort of dying temporarily and seeing family members as clear as I'm looking at this laptop now and actually conversing. And I have read how that can happen, but I can't recall it. And I'm not sure whether they're, again, astral shells. Yeah, I think they're the astral shells still fresh enough to be invested with enough personality to look like the you know, somebody's mum or somebody's dad or son or daughter or whatever. And, you know, I kind of like think when I, because, you know, my dad had me late in life. So he'd gone before I tried DMT. I would love to have spoken to him because he was very worldly wise and open minded. I don't know. I would have loved these kind of discussions with him, but sadly not to be. But I kind of think, you know, when I die, you know, will I get a life review? Will I get to see my dad? And I'm kind of like, hope I do. But then at the back of my mind thinking, well, it's not really my dad. It's not my dad as the true spiritual individual that he was. It's the astral shell of the personality that he was in that lifetime where he was my parent, my dad.
How do you, well, let's see, how should I ask this? Dick, is there a God?
You know what? And you'll see in my books, I have shied away from that. Now, my mom, bless her, she's Christian. So for her, God is Jesus. Or, you know, God is God and he has this son called Jesus. I'm kind of like, I'm with my dad. It's like, my dad told me that, you know, if you could go up into a space and go as fast as you can, you never ever get to the end. It's infinite. And that just blew my little mind. I would think about that every night in bed with my spiritual tinnitus, like trying to imagine getting to the end of the universe. But obviously, if it's infinite, you never can. My dad used to just keep it nice and simple, and he'd say, there must be some supreme power, some supreme intelligence that's behind everything. I suppose that for me is what a lot of people call God. But then when you get into it sort of, you know, philosophically, should you be calling something like that God? And when you read about religions and, you know, maybe gods are the spiritual force at the heart of stars that create systems, or at the heart of planets. I mean, you know, we have what we have, Allah, we have Jova. There's all these different pantheon of gods, each one supposed to be, I don't know, the one, the unique one. So I don't know. I think there are powerful beings that have shaped us and this planet and continue to do so. But, you know, behind everything, there must be some supreme, primal force that will always remain beyond our reckoning, and I that's what the ancients believed. And I think I just lazily say I subscribe to that view that pretty much my dad had. We're never going to know that, so let's just find out what we can know and do our best.
Awesome. And we are approaching the end of our interview today. I do want to open things up one more time and let you go ahead and take the soapbox or the pulpit, whatever you'd like to call it, and just say whatever you would like to say to my audience out there. And feel free, Dick, to follow that up with anything at all you want to plug.
Oh, well, thank you. So if anybody bought the original DMT and My Occult Mind, I want to say thank you very much. It's now retired and no longer available, and I'll never release it again. I self-published, so it wasn't edited, and it was a big tome of a book. It was massive. It's 216,000 words. I have since revised that down and re-released it. I think it was 23rd or 24th of December, from 216,000 words to a mere 45,000 words in this light version. So it's far more accessible. It's available at $7.22, and at that price it's cheap as pie. Ba-bum. In addition to that, there's my second book, DMT and My Occult Mind 2. For me, I'm just going to say I think it's an amazing book, and even though I wrote it, you know, I'm really happy with it. I besought the help of the entities. Sometimes I think they listen, sometimes I think they kind of laughed, and sometimes they just thought, oh, stupid human. But yeah, I'm really happy with both books. The revised version of DMT and My Occult Mind, and DMT and My Occult Mind 2. If you want to look into it, I'd be delighted. Thanks very much.
Excellent. Well, I had a great time today, Dick, and I certainly would love to catch up with you again in the future and see what you're up to.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I got to say, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed your vibe. I thought you asked some really good questions. I think you probably got the best out of me, so I want to say thank you. I really enjoyed it. Obviously, you come onto these, there's always a degree of nerves, but really, really enjoyed it. So thank you. And thanks to everybody who listened in.
Me as well. You did excellent, fantastic interview, and I will talk to you again in the future, my friend.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was researcher and author Dick Kahn. I'm going to go ahead and take us to a break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit and bring things to a close. Thank you. Welcome back to the End of Days. It is me, Daniel, broadcasting to you all the way from that shimmering Emerald City. We just had a great interview with Dit Khan. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. Now, today's a little bit different because we do have a, I suppose you could call it a double feature. There is another show later today. It's at 8 p.m. today. So I'm not going to go super long in the conclusion of this show. After we talk to our guests, we usually like to sit back and chat for a good hour, sometimes multiple hours. But since I'm going to come back tonight, I feel no reason to blow all my energy right now. So I'm going to keep it a little bit shorter, at least for this first show. And then if there's a lot that we have to talk about, we can, of course, do that tonight. We'll stay up nice and late. I woke up early and I'm going to stay up late. So you're going to get a lot of Daniel today. The Seahawks, unfortunately, are out of the playoffs. I know I'm a little bit late with this one, but once my team loses, I do not care about the sport at all. So I don't care about football. I don't care about who's going to the Super Bowl. I don't care about Super Bowl commercials. I don't care about the Pro Bowl. I don't care about any of that stuff. I'm done with football. No more football. And sorry about that. I was hearing a weird sound come through my headphones. Also, I wanted to talk a little bit about vigilante justice. As many of you know, there was a real-life superhero in Seattle. His name was Phoenix Jones. And he was going out there and getting in fights with crackheads and saving people. Or at least trying to. Boy, I'm getting that weird sound again. I don't know what that is. I do apologize. It's really annoying. But I'll figure that out later. But I just wanted to make a point that vigilante justice isn't necessarily wrong. I mean, Phoenix Jones was going out there and he was trying to make a difference. Obviously, it didn't totally work out how he was planning to. I understand that he quit. He didn't feel like people really appreciated what he was doing fully, which is understandable. But I can kind of relate because the police can't always right every wrong. You can't always right every wrong in court. Things aren't always going to work out in your favor. So if you want to go out and wear some kind of superhero costume and go out and kick some butt, that's fine with me. I don't think it's wrong. As you know, with the police, you have a lot of corruption there. Some of them take payoffs. Sometimes people get arrested for things that are ridiculous. You don't always have due process. Bad guys get away. So I don't think it's always wrong for people to take justice into their own hands. I don't think it's wrong to become a superhero or don some kind of mask or do something like that. It's just the thing is, it's not going to be worth it for anybody because you're putting your life on the line. And the same thing's going to happen with Phoenix Jones. You're going to realize, hey, nobody really appreciates what I'm doing here. And I'm putting my life on the line for what? So that some people can stay slightly safer. You start to think, okay, that's the police's job. They're more equipped, blah, blah, blah. That's why you don't have real superheroes. I've thought about that a lot throughout my life. Like, why doesn't anybody become a real Batman or become a real this or that? But we saw that happen with Phoenix Jones. He did it. He was a good MMA fighter. He was able to kind of kick some butt, but he wasn't really able to become this symbol of hope that he was hoping to. People kind of just started to overlook him and see him as a gimmick. The other thing I wanted to talk about are people that are kind of like, you see a lot of this nowadays. You see a lot of people that pretend like they care, but they don't. You see a lot of people that, I suppose you'd call them hypocrites, people that say, hey, I care about this or that. I care about climate change, or I care about starving children, or I care about this or that. But it just comes off really, really phony. If you really care about people, if you want to make a difference, I really feel that you tend to do things in your own life. Like, you're not going to make a big show of it. You don't make a big show of working with charities and stuff like that. Really, I think that you can do good. I've talked about this before. you can do good just helping out somebody that you know, like somebody that's reaching out a hand. Give them some help. And that's a million times better than doing the image thing and aligning yourself with a charity and pretending like you care about something that you probably really don't. I say just see what you can do to the people in your own circle and how can you improve their lives and help them out. I think that's a much better approach. I did want to do the mind-blowing moment of the day, so... Mind-blowing moment of the day. Yeah, that's right. So today's mind-blowing moment of the day. I love the entity stuff. This is kind of a broad topic to pick for mind-blowing moment of the day because we kind of talked about this the whole time. But the whole idea that something could connect with us and communicate in a way other than words to help us understand even better, that's infinitely fascinating to me because I really do feel like that's what's going on out there. I think Dick is really onto something with his research. And when we do connect with these beings, we're doing the same thing that you see in the Bible and stuff like that. Like, it's beyond aliens or technology or anything like that. Whatever we're really dealing with is an occult world that is far more alien and diverse than we would probably ever understand. And hey, that's it. You know what? I'm going to come back later today, so might as well keep this show short. I will talk to you guys. Go to endofdaysradio.com. Get End of Days Radio on iTunes, on Stitcher, anywhere you can get podcasts, iHeartRadio, you should be able to get End of Days Radio. Also go to endofdaysradio.com if you want to donate to the show or check out our schedule. Endofdaysradio.com, endofdaysradio.com, endofdaysradio.com. And I will see you guys later today.